This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that you and I get briefed together on the important questions of the day by people who know what they're talking about. If it works for you, or if it doesn't, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. This week, we're looking at what some commentators believe might be the biggest challenge yet to the future of the European Union, the attempt by two populist parties to form a government in Italy. And if you enjoy this, you might want to listen back to other editions of The Briefing Room. Just type BBC Briefing Room into your favourite search engine. And given the recent report by two influential economics think tanks, you might want to listen to our programme about how to increase funding to the NHS. Anyway, for now, take your seat in The Briefing Room. Several months after its general election gave a majority to two populist parties, Italy now has a new prime minister, law professor Giuseppe Conte.
Fuori da qui c'è un paese che giustamente attende la nascita di un esecutivo.
Outside of this palace, said Giuseppe Conte yesterday, there's a country that rightfully awaits a new government and answers. What is about to be born is the government of change. And, he didn't say, but he might well have, not just change for Italy. The new Italian government is both Eurosceptic and contemptuous of Europe's restrictions on its freedom of action. So this could be much bigger than Brexit for the Union. This, then, is no operetta. What the new Italian government does is important, obviously for Italians, very important for the EU, and pretty important for us in Britain. So, who are Italy's new governors? What do they want? And do they pose a threat to the European Union? Step into the briefing room and find out. First, we need some background. John Foote, a historian at Bristol University, has just published a history of Italy since 1945 called The Archipelago. He starts us off in the Italy of the 1980s. Ci vuole qualche cosa.
Successive post-war governments, and this reached a peak in the 1980s, really brought social peace by through a very, very generous welfare state with a very high, big nationalised sector, and in particular, what became notorious as an example of that generous welfare state was what people call baby pensions, where people could retire after 20 years of public service, often in their 50s, with not a generous pension, but with a pension which went on for maybe another 30 years. And in many ways, Italy's an overbalanced society today because there are large numbers of these pensioners and young people find it very, very difficult to get into the job market. And so there's a huge gap between young and old in that way. In 92-93, a corruption scandal investigation hit the major parties, the Christian Democrats, the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and all of the politicians were involved, or most of them, were caught up in that scandal. There were thousands of arrests, very public trials. It was called Tangentopoli. And that led really to the collapse of all the major parties, which had been mass parties in the post-war period, and to the emergence of new movements, social movements, populist movements, which took the place of these parties. So there was a huge political vacuum in 92-93, at the end of the Cold War and towards the European project becoming more powerful. So I was living in Milan in 92-93, and it was almost daily you'd see arrests on TV of major politicians, trials live on TV, cameras stationed outside the prisons in Milan and other cities, seeing politicians go in, politicians go out, others confessing. It was an extraordinary period because what you saw before your eyes was a system which had run Italy for 50 years collapsing, and nobody knew what was going to happen next. Italy's in ruins in 1992-93 in terms of its political system. No one knows what's going to happen. And out of this, various forces arise. And one of those forces is a very successful businessman called Silvio Berlusconi, who decides to form his own organisation, his own political organisation called Forza Italia, from nothing, from absolutely nothing, based on advertising techniques and his media power. And he stands for election in 1994, never stood before, and wins. And it's one of the most extraordinary moments, I think, in post-war European politics, if not world politics, that someone from nowhere comes and wins the election without a party, without an organisation. And we talk about Macron now and doing that recently, but this is 24 years ago. So I think it really sets the kind of context for all the populist movements that have come since. And Berlusconi, in many ways, invents populism.
Grazie di cuore! Viva l'Italia! Viva Forza Italia! Viva la libertà!
Berlusconi really set the mould for Italian politics from 94 onwards. Everybody had to be a populist. Everybody had to kind of give a personal message. It was all about the individual, the leader. And this infected the left as much as it did the right and the centre-right. So out of the ruins of the Italian left, which had been a glorious, huge communist party with roots right across the country, there emerged something called the Democratic Party, which was a much smaller party, a much weaker party than the old Communist Party. And out of the Democratic Party, there emerged a very young political protege called Matteo Renzi from Florence, who'd been mayor of Florence at a very young age. And he also used a populist message. He saw himself as the man who would throw away, as the term he used, the old left. And very much in the image of Tony Blair, right down to his gestures and his use of technology and his and the way he even spoke, I think he very much modelled himself on Blair. So he was very much something that came out of that tradition, the populist centre-left New Labour tradition. And he rose very quickly to a position of great prominence in the Democratic Party.
In our work together over the past 2 years, I've come to count on Prime Minister Renzi as one of my closest partners and friends on the world stage. By virtue of his progressive vision.
I think he got caught up in the glories of his popularity at that time, around 2015, 2016. And he made the terrible mistake of trying to reform the Italian constitution, which is extremely difficult. And he also said if he held a referendum on these reforms to the Italian constitution and said, if I lose the referendum, I will resign. And of course, that referendum then became a referendum on Renzi. And he lost quite heavily, and he did resign in 2016. Italy today, politically, socially, is unrecognisable from the country that was in place 20, 30 years ago. If a time traveller came back, they wouldn't know what that place was. And one of the ways that you can realise that is that Italy was governed by very well-known politicians for the whole post-war period, people who were household names, like Andreotti, who was seven times prime minister in that period. And the people who are being suggested as prime minister for the new government, which will be formed very soon, you have to Google them. So they're talking about this guy Conte, and everyone's saying, who's he? And they're having to Google him to see who he is. So we have an utterly transformed landscape.
Professor John Foote. So who and what are the two new government parties? Who supports them and what do they want? On the one hand, there's the Five Star Movement. On the other, La Lega, the League. I've invited two experts into the briefing room to tell us about them. Jacopo Iacoboni, who's just written a book about the Five Star Movement, and Cristina Marconi, a journalist on the newspaper Il Messaggero. The new parties seem very exotic to a British eye. So, Jacopo, can you first explain what is the Five Star Movement?
Well, I think this is the first question difficult to answer even for many Italians, but I think little bit easier for Brits paradoxically, because you possibly may know what is the UKIP move and what is the nature of a party which is essentially and basically a tool aimed to a specific task. In the case of the Five Star, the task was to destroy the Italian establishment. This is very engaging for their voters. Essentially, the Five Star were no leftist at all. This is a huge misunderstanding, but they have one target typical of the radical left, which is in Italy to give Italians some kind of minimum wage, universal basic income. And this is one of the reasons many people misunderstood the nature of the Five Star, thinking they were kind of, for example, the Spanish Podemos. But they are not Podemos at all. If you may possibly remember the first rallies with Beppe Grillo in Bologna or
Beppe
in Turin.
Grillo is one of the leaders of the Five Star, isn't
yes,
he?
Yes, Beppe Grillo is a famous comedian, former comedian, Italian comedian, and he, in his shows, was ranting, was shouting, was telling that Italy could get out from Euro, and he embraced a strong Eurosceptical narrative. If you look at, especially at the recent years, you could easily realize that they are increasingly being tough against migrants, not at all xenophobic like the Northern League, their new ally in the Italian government, but kind of similar.
Okay, so Cristina, now let's talk about the Lega. Who are they and who do they appeal to?
So the Lega used to be the Lega Nord, and they then morphed into a party which was not only worried about the rights and the pride of the north of Italy, which is by far richer than the south. So in the 90s, he was mainly caring about the north-south divide, whereas under Salvini, so from 2012...
This is the new leader.
The new leader. It became a party able to appeal to everyone in Italy, which has its main ideological points in its being very fiercely anti-immigration, very fiercely anti-Europe and anti-Germany in particular, and pro-Russian, just in the same way the Five Stars movement is. Under its leader, youngish 45-year-old leader Matteo Salvini, has been incredibly shrewd and good at finding reasons for unhappiness and building his narrative around these reasons for unhappiness.
So it started off the Lega as a regional party saying we're giving too much money to these people down south, and it's now become a more national party by saying to the south we're now taking too many immigrants from outside. Is that broadly it?
It is broadly it, and it became just a party able to appeal to everyone who had reason. I mean, it's strong in the south or in places which would have been like just unthinkable 10 years ago. Migration has been the big scapegoat of the past years, of course, because Italy has been like objectively under a lot of pressure. But it's not only that. It is like the role of the ECB, the role of the European Commission.
ECB.
Yes, European Central Bank. The role of the European Commission, the competition from Germany and the fact that Germany was imposing austerity on Italy, which were all things which have been like massively blamed by Salvini with a lot of success.
It's clear what the Lega is against. So what does it stand for? What would it actually want to do?
I would describe it as like UKIP meets Alternative für Deutschland with some kind of respect for Orban. So it
in Hungary, the leader of Hungary.
So it stands for sovereignty. It stands for sovereignty, both personal and national. Its anti-European narrative has stayed stronger than the one of the Five Stars movement, which has been more uncertain in the past. Their idea is very much to pick up a fight with Brussels.
Although Five Star, I think, got many more votes than the Lega sounds more actually ideologically coherent than Five Star. Jacopo, do you think that's true?
I think this is true because the Five Star are an entirely new animal. For one respect, they are a catch-all party and they can mix from all the spectrum many issues ranging from the minimum wage to the no immigration to many, many promises to cut Italian privilege and to cut parliamentary wage. Little things in economic terms, but very impressive for the Italian people, which, as Cristina said, is profoundly frustrated from a kind of or crisis or huge stagnation in the last year.
There are big proposals which will add significantly to government expenditure.
Yes.
There are big proposals which will diminish government revenue by cutting taxes, unless you find somewhere to get it from. How does the new government in its compact envisage that it will be able to square this circle?
So, on one hand, there has been a lot of talking in the past years about how much money is wasted in Italy. So there is still this strong sense that you can save money somewhere. On the other hand, what they think is that austerity can kill. Austerity has killed. So we don't really need, it's just kind of a European invention that you have to have your books balanced and that you have to keep everything under control, that somehow the expansion of economy will bring some benefits. And what they say in the agreement of government they recently published is that their strategy is to cut the debt through growth. So trying to make growth stronger thanks to investment. Will it work? We don't know.
Cristina Marconi there and Jacopo Iacoboni. Italy is the third biggest economy in the Eurozone and one of the founders of what's now the European Union. It was, after all, the Treaty of Rome. Now, as we've heard, Eurosceptics govern it. As that other Roman, Frankie Howard, might have asked, what does this portend? Joining me now in the briefing room are Ferdinando Giuliano, who's a columnist and leader writer on European economics for Bloomberg Opinion. He's in Rome. And Judy Dempsey, a former Brussels correspondent and now a senior fellow at the Carnegie Europe think tank. She's in Berlin. Ferdinando Giuliano, how well is the Italian economy performing right now?
Well, actually, it's doing better than it was just a few years ago, as we have growth returning. It's roughly the same rate as the UK, and unemployment is slowly coming down. The problem is there is this big legacy of the crisis. Really, the Italian economy is still smaller than it was before the sovereign debt crisis. Unemployment is still very high. And of course, there is this big legacy problem of Italian debt, which is really not a consequence of the crisis, though it's made it slightly worse. It's a consequence of the policies which were pursued in the 80s and which have brought it to 130% of gross domestic product. That's one of the highest in the world.
Now, to what extent is the euro, the constraints of the eurozone, a cause of Italy's economic difficulties? You talked about the legacy of the 80s, but these parties seem to point more towards what they think the eurozone has imposed upon them.
Well, the euro certainly made it harder for the Italian government and obviously the rest of the elite to run the economy, because obviously it imposes constraints. For example, the monetary policy is set by the European Central Bank, and there are limits to the way you can run your own fiscal policy. Your tax and spending decisions are constrained. However, most economists believe that Italy's problem are really linked to its productivity crisis. Italy's productivity has been rising very, very slowly throughout the past 2.5 decades. And that means that actually they predate the arrival of the euro. Italy had a massive problem also in terms of global competition. When China came to the world by coming into the World Trade Organization, many of its products competed against Italian products. I mean, think about cheap textiles, for example. They used to be made in Italy, now they're made in China and increasingly in Vietnam and other countries. And also remember, whether Italy, you know, regardless of the euro, Italy would still have this very high debt. That means that actually it doesn't really have that much room to increase spending or cut taxes. And that's not down to bureaucrats in Brussels or in Frankfurt. It's down to the bond market, which will be watching closely any, you know, big promise to spend by any government.
Now, looking at the economic programmes of the two parties that are now form this coalition, how compatible are the economic policies of these parties?
Well, if you take them at face value, they are completely incompatible with the constraints which we've described and with the European rules. What happened is that they had two different platforms. I mean, there were aspects which were shared. For example, they both want to abolish a pension reform, which was passed at the height of the sovereign debt crisis to make it easier for people to retire. That's something which they both had in their program, and it's still there. But there were other pledges. For example, the Northern League, the League had promised to cut income tax through a so-called flat tax, by, you know, cutting taxes to income tax to 15%. And then the Five Star Movement, on the other hand, had this very generous income support scheme, which they call universal basic income, even though it's not quite a universal basic income. It means that everyone should earn at the very least 780 euros a month. Now, these two pledges were separately in their program. What happens in the coalition agreement? They're simply put one on top of the other. What that means is that if you sum up all their various giveaways, independent estimates say that this is going to cost up to 125 billion euros a year in extra spending or lower tax receipts, which would really boost Italy's budget deficit to around, you know, some people say, think, you know, around 10% of GDP. That's an enormous amount of spending. Especially, remember, we are in an economic recovery. Usually what economists think is that when there are the good times, you should try to lower your budget deficit so that when there is a crisis, you can expand it again and provide relief to the economy.
Now, my faulty memory of basic economics is that if you try to do something like that, then the cost of your borrowing goes stratospheric and you end up paying more and more to service the amount of debt that you've got, and that eventually the whole lot comes tumbling down on your head. Or am I wrong?
Well, I think, you know, that's we're already starting to see some signs of that. Since the initial draft of the coalition agreement was leaked, Italian borrowing costs have gone up from, say, you know, on 10-year bonds, which is the benchmark rate, they've gone up from 1.7% to around 2.3%, 2.4%. So that's a small change, but it's telling us that, you know, investors are taking notice. Remember, at the moment in the Eurozone, we still have the European Central Bank, which is buying a lot of, you know, Eurozone government debt, which means that investors know they can, you know, even if they have an Italian bond, they can sell it to the ECB. That helps to keep borrowing costs down. However, we know that the ECB is planning to limit and then end this asset purchases around, the turn of the year, autumn, the beginning of 2019. That means that, you know, investors are going to be even more concerned about Italian debt in 4 or 5 months' time. And that's precisely when the new government will have to present its first budget. And that could make really an explosive combination.
Now, Judy Dempsey, let's talk about what this all means for Europe and for the Eurozone. As far as we can tell, any constraint upon Italian capacity for expanding the economy by borrowing more and creating more debt is going to be blamed on the Eurozone. Could you take us through how the countries of the Eurozone and the Eurozone itself will respond to an Italian demand to be able to increase its debt?
The Eurozone is completely divided over the future of the Eurozone. They are divided over President Emmanuel Macron's rather ambitious reforms. And of course, Germany is very much unprepared to toe the line in terms of what the French president wants to do. In other words, the Italian crisis comes at the worst possible moment for Macron's reforms, and it comes for the worst possible moment even for the future stability of the Eurozone. It's very fragile at the moment.
So let's take us through how that threat actually works. Presumably, you have this new Italian government. It says we want to borrow more. And what then happens and how does the crisis then take shape?
Well, it depends on, first of all, looking at the huge public debt, it depends on how much they want to borrow and the ECB's willingness to pour money into the Italian economy. And as Ferdinando said, so much will depend on the bonds. This is the first thing. Secondly, what about the reaction in Berlin? Do they really want the ECB to keep bailing out or making very heavy transfers to Italy, knowing that the reforms will be very, very slow? I would imagine Germany will try to put as much pressure on whoever takes over the reins of government in Rome, but it won't be all plain sailing for the Germans to do this. Then, on the other side, you have Paris. Macron was waiting for a year for Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, to first of all, win the election, secondly, to put a government in place. And you know what? He's still waiting for her to reply to his reforms, which really focus on integration of the Eurozone.
Are you saying that the... because at one level, you could say that the threat from the new Italian government would strengthen the Macron view that you need integration to stop governments doing this kind of thing. On the other hand, you can see that the Germans, and we saw it over Greece as well, take a fairly dusty view of ending up having to bail out what they see as profligate economies.
Absolutely. And the small German investor. Let me go back to the first point. The Italian political setup, if it is realised, actually doesn't play into Macron's hands precisely because they are Eurosceptic. And Macron's philosophy and the intellectual architecture that he has set up is primarily based on tightening up the Eurozone, bringing it much more closely together, really integrating it. And so this would go against the Rome's position. And then, of course, you could argue that Rome's position might play into Merkel's hands. But in fact, as you say, the German finance ministry and the chancellery do not want Italy to have huge access to any amount of funds which will not be used to actually restructure the economy.
And you're saying that what's happening in Italy could seriously derail the possibilities of reform in Europe?
Say if you turn it around the other way and be counterintuitive and say, well, actually, here's the chance now to finally let the Italian crisis show and confirm why a radical reform of the Eurozone is needed.
OK, Ferdinando, let's look forward a bit. If you had to guess where the Italian coalition and its policies will stand in a year's time, what would be your intuition?
Well, I still find it hard to imagine that they will be able to pass a budget in the autumn. So I'm still, you know, curious to see how they do that. There are a set of constraints they need to overcome. The first one is actually the Italian constitution, which has a clause which says that Italy should balance its budget over taking into account the economic cycle. This was inserted at the height of the sovereign debt crisis. So if they try to pass, you know, a very expansionary budget, the Italian president could very easily veto that, you know, that set of measures. Then there is the bond market, which we discussed will take a very careful look at their policies. And then there will be Europe, which, as Judy has rightly said, will, you know, be screaming about any violation of the budget rules. So I still see as an opportunity that the two parties will take all these, you know, as an opportunity to try and have a new election. Remember, ultimately, you know, these are strange bedfellows. They're getting on fine, but they may prefer to run the country on their own. And, you know, there is still a possibility that they could try and use this opportunity as a, you know, the all the constraints they face from Europe to the president to the bond market and say, look, we want to do what you voters have told us to do, but they're not letting us. So let's have a new election. So I still think, you know, there is a possibility that this government may actually not last very long.
So if you were the Commission in Brussels, Judy, how worried would you currently be about what's happening in Italy?
I'd be extremely worried. I mean, if you think Greece was a problem and all the problems and threats of Brexit, just consider what Italy's like. One of the world's biggest economies, one of the founding members of the EU. For Italy to go down under, for Italy to maintain this Euroscepticism, it would impose enormous damage on the EU and probably jeopardise Macron's ambitious plans for the Eurozone.
Judy Dempsey there and Ferdinando Giuliano. So, sum up, one thing that Italy's populist governing parties can agree on is that if things don't work out, it'll all be Europe's fault. And also, things probably won't work out. My thanks to John Foote, Jacopo Jacoboni, Christina Marconi, Ferdinando Giuliano and Judy Dempsey. And we'll be back next week. Till then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Emma Bishop. And please let us know what you think about this programme or indeed the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And we really do appreciate hearing from you.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.